you know, now, yes, I am not by any means erasing external conditions.
No.
Yes, oppression is real. Patriarchy, white supremacy, capitalism. Yeah. All real.
Mm-hmm.
And within whatever those constraints, there's always still some, even if it's an inch, there's some room to move.
Greetings and welcome to the Emergent Strategy Podcast, hosted by the Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute. We're a collective of facilitators, mediators, trainers, and overall really curious human beings who are interested in how we get in right relationship with change. I'll be guiding our interview, and I'm Sage. At ESII, I'm known as the architect. In Emergent Strategy, as a reminder for some, is the way we generate and reshape complex systems and patterns through relatively simple interactions. And today's guest is Alta Starr. One of my favorite parts of doing the podcast is sort of tooling the internet and learning things about people I had not known before. I have crossed paths, know Alta from the amazing work as one of the founding trainers at BOLD, Black Organizing for Leadership and Dignity. Alta is a gifted tarot reader, movement worker, somatics practitioner, and I have since learned also poet, former music producer. So I'm excited for our conversation to be really deeply connected to all of the ways we think about transformation and shaping change, and also the ways cultural and artistic work can play roles in that, right? Like, and so, welcome, Alta. How are you today?
I am delighted to be here with you, Sage. That's how I am. And to hear you, to see you, to participate in this amazing project that ESII is taking on. ESII, it's like saying, how you doing? I'm I.
That's ESII. Right.
You know, it's definitely got that little trill on it. And it's the end of the day, so it's lovely to be in this kind of more expansive conversation after being in meetings most of the day.
Well, so grateful for your yes on so many levels, for your yes in this moment and for the yes you share with the world. So one of the things that we get excited about in this podcast is creating just a list of folks that we're like, oh, actually, I'm watching this person move in the world, and I believe they're an emergent strategist. And so when I look at the breadth of even just the intro that we talked about, and when I think about some of the principles of emergent strategy, interdependence, decentralization, nonlinear and iterative, creating more possibilities, these are just a few of the themes that I feel like run through how I see you moving through the world. Does that resonate for you? And can I call you an emergent strategist?
I would be honored for you to call me that. I will happily take that title. It's so interesting. Emergence, to me, in some ways, it's like about surfing the edge of change. It's being right there. You know, I don't surf. I don't even swim. Put me down. I can't swim. So let's be clear. I'm using a metaphor that I may not embody, but that's okay. I've watched waves a lot. And you know how a wave, if you imagine, mm-hmm. I'm imagining what surfers do, that you're right there on the edge mm-hmm. of the wave and you want to stay with it before it turns into surf. And in a way, that to me mm-hmm. is what emergent strategy is about. It's like staying with what is as you move towards what's becoming, right? That next wave, that, as opposed to hitting the surf and just going down, which is okay, because guess what? There'll be another wave. But definitely, I feel as if there's a way of deep listening to people, to action, to what's happening, that is very much a part of emergent strategy. That being with change is all there is, be like water. Maybe that's why the surf metaphor comes to mind. But that, you know, that sense, I mean, those are some of the things that feel very dear to me and very much a part of how I move in the world. Presence too, that, I mean, there's such a sense of that emergent strategy talks about, you know, presence in relationships, presence in you know, being small enough to actually see who you're with, the importance of trust, all those things seem to me to be also about this kind of deep, deep here and now. Be here now. Attend to where you came from, vision where you're going, but don't leave this moment to be in either one.
Wow. That is one of the most elegant analogies I've heard around emergent strategy yet. So know that that's going to show up in some other places, because that what I also imagine, I don't surf, I swim a little bit, but I don't surf, is that, yeah, you actually have to be, like, you can't surf and look behind you, right? You have to really, and the ability to feel what it means to be on that edge and to ride that edge is, it is, yes, there's a science to surfing, right? Yes, there are skills and things you learn. Yes, there's paddling and the weight of your board and all of those things. But there's also that moment. What does it mean to be in that moment and to be attuned to what adjustments need to be made so that you can stay on that edge of change as it continues to happen?
Yes. And being fully present in yourself, in your body. So, I mean, for me, it's also, it feels like so many things that I've studied and learned and investigated over a lifetime, you know, kind of, they've been narrowing, or not narrowing, integrating, weaving into a single thread. And part of it is about really being in the body, to be present and notice where you are and to feel those changes underneath you. On the surfboard or in society.
Yes.
You gotta be in the skin you're in, right?
Yes. Alan, I appreciate you talking about all the things that you've learned. I would love to talk with you about the pieces that are integrating, right? Like, there's so many, you know, your history and movement, your political lineage, your practices. What are some things that feel really important for us to know and share, you know?
So sort of where I came from, I guess. I mean, so I just want to start by, I like saying it sometimes. I'm 70 years old.
Ashe.
You know,
yes.
I am 70s. I've been around for a minute. And, you know, when I think about, I'm writing something these days about how we can be with history, because there's a way that, especially in this moment with the rise of authoritarianism and whatever, you know, I'll talk with folks in movement, younger folk, and there can be such frustration and even edging on despair. And that sense of, I wonder how many times actually the world has ended for someone or for some people. And if I think about just in the course of my lifetime, not maybe so much the moments when I felt the world was ending, but that was in the air. I mean, you know, you live through the assassination of a president, whether you like him or not, right? You're 10 years old.
Yes.
It's a big deal, especially on the heels of the Bay of Pigs and civil defense drills. And I'm just talking about the, you know, the kind of in the air terror, to say nothing then of the specific terror of being Black in the late 50s, the early 60s, the mid 60s, having a brother in SNCC in Mississippi during, you know, the times of the Mississippi Terror. Anyway, all of those things, just to say that some of what has shaped me to be able to be in this time and say, yeah, there's fear here, there's terror, there's grief, and there is knowing the world ends and the world continues, and how to be in that, really holding it. The world ends and the world blossoms. You know, I just think that it's another balancing act in a way to be able to hold both. And I think we deny either at our peril. So that's one thread that feels really integrated in me, the sense of great loss, great despair, and enormous embodied faith that everything's already all right and will be.
That's
some of it I can talk about. You want me to keep going? Because I got more.
We have so much more, but I just need to take a pause in a moment for that, because one of the literal questions that was sent in when Adrian and Mia knew I was going to talk to you, Adrian said, ask Alta, she once told me everything is already okay. What did you mean by that, and how do you hold that stance? And I feel like you just already landed us there in some ways, right? This, that the complexity of the world turning over is not the fear, right? It's not that there's something around, actually, I'm going to ask you a follow-up then, because what I hear in that is the part of what I think the apocalypse and this sort of despair that folks get is a fear of a loss of something, right? And either like missing an opportunity to live in a certain way or like to bring forth something or a literal loss. Like we're having this conversation in 2022. We're watching what's happening with the state, you know, and this idea of like what's being taken away. But there's something about what you were sharing of the world ending and continuing that I'm curious how you see loss, or do you see loss, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just sitting with that and really feeling, because I want to say it as succinctly and clearly as possible, in that I am of the school that loss and the grief that goes with it is the coin that we pay for love. And, you know, when people shut down to feeling loss, they're shutting down to love. I mean, that's one of the thoughts I had about, you know, what shaped me. One of the questions that's really compelling to me these days is, how much do we actually determine of reality, and how much is it given that that's the way things are, and therefore what we get to determine is how we're going to be with it. So I don't have an answer. It's just a constant exploration, because as a child of the era that I grew up in, as someone who got sent, I don't even know how, to some damn class at the local college in existentialism when I was in high school. Yo, I'm an existentialist. What the fuck does that mean? Yeah. It means that I really do truly believe that we make it up. We make up meaning, and we are responsible for the meanings and interpretations that we make up. So tied to that, this idea of allowing ourselves to be affected by our experience, to have open hearts, to feel, to love, and to lose. It feels very much about being in existence, in reality as it is, and taking responsibility for what we experience.
Wow. Okay, I forgot to do my grab your pen and paper, folks, because it's about to go there, if you have, because I'm making notes, because one of the things that, like I said, in your intro, the places that I know you, that you're one of the founding trainers of, is Black Organizing for Leadership and Dignity. And and also naming yourself as an existentialist, right? Like, and I know without a doubt there are folks that might feel like there's something at odds with those things, right? Like, how do you organize towards and also hold that everything is okay? Like, how do you determine how to move? And what does that mean about presence? And so, yeah, I'm tell us more. I want a really good question.
Well, I mean, I'm a little stumped by the question, but that talks about the limits and the bias, you know, of the lens I have. I'm just really owning this. We are all making it up all the time, but a lot of us lie about that.
Woo, okay. All right, yeah, it's getting hot now, yep.
Right, right, and there's something about that, you know. Now, yes, I am not by any means erasing external conditions.
No.
Yes, oppression is real, patriarchy, white supremacy, capitalism, all real. And within whatever those constraints, there's always still some, even if it's an inch, there's some room to move. Malcolm Little became Malcolm X in prison, y'all. There's some room to move. There's some choice to make. So this question of acknowledging that we're making choices, and you know, it might sound like to me, yes, I am a healer. Yes, I am a coach. Yes, I am a somatics practitioner. Yes, I recognize trauma and the incredible distortions and damage that it creates in people's lives. And deep breath. Inside of that, there is still some part of anyone that is already healed and already whole. And how to access and live from that. And that's more how do we each do it, not so much how does the healer do it for you. I mean, the healer is accompanying you, right? That's what I have on. I hope that's an answer to this idea of reconciling them. But I choose to believe in, and again, with all due respect and acknowledgement to the bigger forces, I choose to really land on our capacity for responsibility, agency, and choice.
No, that is absolutely an answer I needed, and I'm sure others needed to hear as well as we think about choice. One of the things that's becoming clear to me already, I think we're, 10 minutes in, is a particular way you hold complexity. And by complexity, I simply mean multiple things simultaneously and how you see the integration of them. And so most folks who've listened to this know that I've been working art and culture for most of my time. And so I was really excited to talk with you, particularly about the relationship between language and the body as a poet and a somatics practitioner, and how what the relationship between those can offer us about how we navigate change.
Thank you for that question. It's so close to my heart, Sage. I mean, you write in the territory of my soul there, because, you know, language can either be such a tool, such a weapon of separation, separating us from ourselves, from our feelings, from our spirit, from separating us from each other, separating us from life, from the land. And that's a lot of how it gets used, right? That's a lot of how systems of oppression and hierarchical systems recreate themselves. That there is a language that you need to know to move in them or to succeed in them. So that's one side of what language is. And yet there is a way that every single cell is a word, right? Every muscle, every tissue. I mean, as I sit here and I'm just dropping in, I mean, I'm feeling my own body. I'm feeling, okay, my toes, the bottom of my feet. I'm listening. I'm hearing. That sense of what is the language that connects? What is the language that brings me into a wholeness where my mind, the part that tends to get most exercised by language, is in its right role. You know, I detest the kind of anti-intellectual tradition that can sometimes show up in the somatics discourse. You know, it's like, oh, the mind, oh, thought, oh, intellect, they're bad. Well, no, they're just out of place. They just think they're somebody they're not. It's like, you know, let's give the voice to all the rest of what's in us so that part of us can be in right role. And we can be integrated. So you talk about complexity and integration. True language comes from deep silence that allows for the presence of everything. That's what I'm feeling. I mean, so you're just hearing it kind of ripple up and out from my belly, from my heart, from my lungs. Yeah. That sense of, I have deep respect for silence. I don't think we allow enough silence in our conversations in our own heads or with other people or in the world. And that can send me off on a whole other tangent about essentialism, but I'm not going there. Anyway, language, poetry. I love poetry because of its compression and its respect for silence. Poetry, to me, like jazz, is as much about playing the space as it is the notes. What's left out is as important. But the biggest thing for me about language is reclaiming all the languages that have been muted in the brassy, braying over-assertion of language by the dominant culture and then by the reactivity in the oppressed cultures.
Oh, that's so helpful and so thoughtful. I think part of where I dropped in was the right sizing, right? And thinking about, because of our disconnection, negation of the wisdom of the body, Mm-hmm. That the mind is sort of filling in. Mm-hmm. And so on one hand, I had this moment while I was listening to it, I was like, oh, I'm grateful for my mind for like trying to help. Mm-hmm. And if I right-size everything else, it has space to fall back. Yes. And be in relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a different way.
Yeah. And to serve more as a translator, right? That the mind and words, they help us connect to each other. Right. But if it's running the show, then it's leaving behind all the wisdom, you know, as we say, from the neck down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the neck mm-hmm. down. Let's go. Let's take it just even deeper into the body.
Okay.
And I wanted to, you mentioned a little earlier about the work that you've done with folks around trauma, Black folks in particular, you know, around trauma and thinking about sort of epigenetics, which is like the sort of ancestral, like generational trauma that can live in our bodies. And I wanted to ask you just from your vantage point of being someone who supports movement leaders and folks in so many different ways, not even just in movement leaders, well, sports movement leaders in so many different ways, because I'm like, you know, in all of your mediums, how you see that playing out and what lessons is it teaching us or, you know, what does it have to offer us around?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Great question. And because epigenetics in some ways is such a young field. That's the way I'll put it. You know, I mean, that it's emerging. There's so much more to learn and to know. I'm fascinated by the fact that in some ways, some of what I've read about it and studied about it, it affirms teachings that weren't grounded in biology, right? That there are so many theories about the intergenerational passing of trauma, or for that matter, even without going to trauma, of stories. I mean, that if you look back at some of the work about family patterns and intergenerational transmission, and you'll see, you know, where families are living out, you know, things that their ancestors a generation or two generations back did and didn't know the story. So you say, well, was that carried in the body? Or is it in, or was it, I mean, the old theory used to be is that it was inculcated or taught by the family system, right? That the family system is going to keep repeating its pattern. So I'm just fascinated by there being multiple theories about why it is we seem so shaped by what happened before and how much of that gets carried forward. So then when I think about what shows up in movement or what shows up among Black folks, and I was just reading this recently, you know, we need to remember, you know, it's not really even been 200 years in the United States that Black folks have been free, right? Is that right? Is my math right? Yeah, I mean, we're getting there. We got a few more years to go. And 200 years is really not very long. I mean, I can remember when, you know, when I used to do lots of work in the South doing funding of organizing there, and I would go to meetings there, or people would have talks at churches, and this sense of how immediate, how present slavery was for people in a way that you did not encounter in the North, right? Now, there are reasons in the social conditions for that. I mean, if you are living with the possibility of your home being bombed, you have a different and very immediate kind of reality around the struggle against white supremacy is going to look very different in New York or Chicago or wherever else where it may be acted out more by the police than folks in white robes. But the point being that immediacy and the short length of time means that we're still right up against the waves of what that was without even, before we even get to what's showing up in the body. An example, inside of Bowl Directors in Leeds, we have it's a course that we do, 16-day course for directors of organizations and lead organizers, the leadership level. And we've, over the past 4 years or so, included a piece around time. And we've shaped it a couple of different ways, being about reclaiming your time, being about reclaiming timelessness and the experience of flow, actually being in that amazing, you know, sweet, creative space of just, oh, I'm in my groove here. Whatever, different ways of forming it. But part of what it includes is a kind of irritating, you know, okay, log your time for a couple of weeks. Boy, we have had people go off. That's some white shit. Excuse my French. Why are you bringing that in here? That's some corporate stuff. That's about controlling me. You know, and then somebody else will say, you know, oh, that's just us being unaccountable. We got to do it. I mean, we've had real debates, right? Because of, if your time, I mean, and people certainly who have experienced incarceration, I think might have some right to talk about, I don't want to look at my time. I've had the experience of my time being controlled. I mean, that wounding, right, is so immediate.
Yeah.
For a lot of the rest of us, I think something else might be going on that feels a little performative and a little, you know, it's that kind of what I call some of the ways that we short circuit our own possibility through arguments that come out of a kind of framework of essentialism that make, you know, because we're gonna, we want to be evidence of the abuse. We want to live, some way or another, we're going to continue in that path as opposed to fully embracing our freedom. So I know that's, it's not exactly to the epigenetic question, but clearly the past lives in us. However it gets there, whether it's getting there because of the ways that trauma has lived in the bodies of our mothers and our fathers and impacted our genes, and we've got genes that are switched on to make us more alert and hypervigilant to stress and danger, or it's because our families and our community networks are going to continue to recreate patterns and ways of being together, both that are positive and nourishing and nurturing and that are destructive, and we get cast in certain roles, you know, the baby boy that everybody says, oh, you're so pretty, you're gonna break hearts. And then when he grows up and is a womanizer, we wonder why. Anyway, you know, just, I mean, there are many, many, many different ways that the programming happens. And I think in the body, in the family, in the culture, and how we wake up to what's driving us and to what extent we have choice and agency feels like our work and the work inside of movement, the work inside of programs like BOLD that are attempting to encourage and support people to be present and choiceful, the ways that people can engage with each other so destructively. I mean, we all can talk about that in movement, right? And where those patterns might come from, as opposed to patterns that are more truly about both being with each other's pain and challenging each other to be our best.
No, thank you for that, that challenge and that offering, because I also think about the same framework, but with pleasure. And if we can talk about it in relationship to trauma, can we also find ways to talk about it in relationship to pleasure? And I was thinking yesterday, I decided, whoever's vegan here, turn off your meat, you know, to make some turkey wings, right? Like, and
yeah,
I sure did.
Did you smell the room, girl?
I sure did. Oh, okay. Sorry. And so I was having this moment. This is what happens in my kitchen, right? I'm having this moment thinking about the way that it soothes me to make, not only just eat them, but to make them. Of course, yes, they were smothered, because that's the, there's a certain both cultural transmission from being in the kitchen with my mother and eating the food historically. But I also started to kind of play in my mind about, if we think about things are transmitted through DNA, through bloodline, you know, in around the way trauma lives in our body, does that also mean that pleasure can do the same thing?
Yes, yes. What a wonderful question and exploration to be in. Absolutely. Where do we learn what's pleasurable and the permission to allow it? And I think that it's absolutely right that the question, you know, sits side by side with questions about trauma, because of course, some of what can get shut down or does get shut down with trauma is a capacity for pleasure. And one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is, that how vulnerable it can be to express our joy, right? That we often, a lot of us have this awareness when we talk about being vulnerable, which we vulnerable. We're here, we're alive, we're on the planet, guess what? And we are once we put our guns and nuclear weapons down, we're probably the most defenseless animal on the planet. So we are vulnerable. So let's just accept that. And then from there, though, the question, you know, it's like, oh, to be vulnerable means showing I'm hurt, or means showing where I'm soft or could be hurt. Whereas, you know what? Actually, I think a lot of people hesitate to reveal their joy and their pleasure. It's scary. Somebody might take it away. Hmm. So thinking about, you know, there's the permission to have it. There's the permission to radiate it and reveal it. And what allows us, whether it's in the body or, you know, as you say, in those cultural transmissions, I do think that so much of it starts with come back to the body and feel it. Hmm. Just feel it, you know? Ask yourself, where is joy? I've done a lot of work around who are we in the part of us that's not wounded? Because I really do believe that the wounds come and go, right? You know, you know, I got this scratch on my arm or this burn. It's going to heal. And under that and inside me, there's so many things that aren't scratched or burned. So when I access and live from that, what allows me to? And one of the things, you know, clearly experiences of pleasure, but most of all, my very favorite, awe.
Just awe. Yes.
At the magnificent, at the beautiful, at, you know, that breathtaking piece of music, that amazing sunrise, the joy in that child's face, them damn smothered turkey wings, you know, whatever, you know, the things that just cause you to just feel, one, to know I'm not everything and I'm not even the center of everything, but I belong. Mm-hmm. And I'm connected to all of this. I mean, it's just, you know, and then there are the things that often don't get mentioned when we talk about trauma and trauma studies and resilience and recovering from trauma. There are all these things that have to do with living a fulfilled and satisfied life. You know, it's almost as if you're over here in the corner healing from trauma, you don't get to this other side. But purpose, kind of knowing what you're up to and why, knowing you can learn, all those things too are part of it.
I love that. Yeah. And it makes me think about something you said earlier about our need to be the evidence of the abuse. And if we allow ourselves to both deeply feel and show our joy, our awe, does that imply that the abuse is not that bad, right? Like, and you've mentioned the word essentialism twice. You're like, I'm not going to go there. Oh. But you brought it back a little bit later. And so for folks, just a little, can you give us a little bit about what that means to you, like what you're seeing, and that's bringing that up so that folks who may not be familiar with it have some sense of some container for it.
Well, it's just the idea that we are a certain way. We, Black people, we, women, we, you know, boom. This is what it is to be that. And some of this even was sparked for me recently just by reading an article. I think it was a Latina writing in, I don't remember where, but, you know, about this idea of, you know, how middle class white culture says quiet down, and that, you know, it's kind of like, well, hell to the no, we are going to be expressive and big and volume, great. And it's different from saying this is how I'm expressing my joy and what I am choosing, and saying this is what and who I am, which will tend to exclude other options. I mean, if we all got to be big and take up space and be full of volume all the time, what are we losing and not getting to have? So that's what I'm talking
about.
Exhausting. Yeah, it's that sense of as opposed to defining ourselves as able to be anything that humans can be. We cut out a piece and say, that's our piece. Mm-hmm. And we're going to protect it at all costs. That's what I'm talking about with essentialism. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that. My daddy used to say, you know somebody's lying when they say always and never.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's right. That's right.
So one of the things that I wind up quoting you on, that this may be the first time you're hearing this, but I was doing some work with people in education, a PI editor, and I was working with their resilience package. And I was like, what a quote from Alta, right? Like, and I was reminded of that when you talked about the cut and it heals, and then there's all the layers underneath it. And so one of the definition of resilience that you give in their toolkit around resilience is, it is our ability to connect and cultivate our innate aliveness, which is, it feels like a definition that of resilience that engages more than just our bounce back abilities.
Right? And I do think, and okay, so now I will do the thing that I just said is the thing I don't like for us to do. But I think that that's one of the things, one of the offerings and gifts and contributions of Black folks and Black culture. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. It's not about bouncing back. Uh-huh. It's about life and really being it and fully letting it move through us and be in the world.
I love that.
Yeah. And we know something about that. And there's a lot of ways that we don't, you know, or that we can shut it down or hide it. But overall, you know, I mean, I'm looking up at over there on my altar, I've got John Coltrane, James Baldwin, James and Lorraine Hansberry dancing together, James and Nina, their little heads together, and then there's Alice Coltrane looking all serious and spiritual in the corner. They're all in a frame, you know, but it's just, yeah, what do we know? What do we know? And not to claim the other individual's gifts, but because, and then going back to my existentialism, because they've done it, it has made a possibility or an invitation for everyone else. I'm a keeper of the moon.
Gratitudes for that. I think there's what do we know and how do we know what we know? And so that leads me to the other, I won't say other realm, into the fullness of the ways you and I have engaged and what I was excited to talk to you about. Yeah. And that is you as a gifted tarot reader. How do we know? Can you tell me about, about your tarot practice and how that grounds you and how you use that?
So I have been playing with tarot, and it really is about play for me, since 1973. And the thing I want to say about play, one of the slogans that shaped me is from 1968. I now know a lot more about where it came from politically that I didn't know back then, but I always loved the slogan. It is love without limit, play without restraint, live without dead time. Ooh. Yes, love without limit, which may have its little Christian origins. That's okay. Play without restraint, which actually I think in the French is enjoy without restraint, and is as much about unfettered sexual expression and experience as anything else. And then live without dead time, which is really about getting free of, you know, how capitalism messes us up. But at any rate, that slogan and this idea of play and the existentialist idea of we're making it up all the time, tarot lets me do those things. Playing with tarot and playing with art. And here's a little story on me. I realized when I was very young, I don't know, 6, 7, I made a Mother's Day card, which I found when I was packing up my mother's possessions after her death. And in this card, which is on construction paper, there's this little girl and she's pushing a baby carriage. And you can't really tell what it is in the baby carriage. When you open the card, what it says is, "My baby is art. Happy Mother's Day."
I love that. Let me tell you
something. Okay. I don't know where it came from, but you know, 78 pieces of art in every tarot deck, 78 images or symbols, 78 ways to engage the imagination with structures of meaning that I then get to pick from and to make it up. So it's all, you know, so what is my practice? I do a daily card pull at the end of the day. And the question that I am using is usually something along the lines of, What are my lessons from today? So I don't use it predictively. I use it to reflect and, you know, then engaging that question and that image, that symbol, that space in between, playing the spaces is about what's the meaning. And then, of course, I get to carry that reflection into my dreams. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what I'm up to with tarot. I also write about tarot in the sense of using it as a jumping off or prompt piece for going deeper into symbolism and possible meaning and anything else that I wanted to say about it. I mean, that I'm getting more comfortable talking about it. Clearly, there's a way that where this lives for me is very separate from, how do I want to put it? I've been working on a set of essays now for a few years called Conjugating Freedom. And it's the explorations of a materialist skeptic.
My goodness. I love everything about that.
Because I am completely skeptical. I don't accept anything on face value. I really want to know what makes it work. Yes, I am convinced by and live in and really appreciate materialist approaches, analyses, ways of structuring our action. And I live in a world of symbols. That's where I play. Maybe that's what I should say. I get to play in the world of symbols. And it is playing there offers a real challenge to all the ways that we structure reality that finally constrain and control and keep us in place. So, like I said, I didn't know where some of this stuff comes from, but at the moment I might say, yeah, I'm joining the Situationists, okay?
I love it. And I love it. They're like, what are you doing over there, Alta? I don't know. You're like, I'm over here. I'm like, well, is there something over there? Well, I appreciate you sharing about your practice and sharing that with us here, because there's so many spaces. Tarot is showing up in so much movement space in a lot of ways. And I think I'm really interested in talking with folks who have an experience with it and what it can offer and what it particularly what feels resonant to me of what you just said was this like third space. There's the question and the image, and then there's the meaning and all the tools that we have to make meaning of the world that we live in, and that you pull at the end of the evening, even just that. Thank you for sharing that. I'm like, that's something interesting, right?
Yes, it's a practice.
Oh, yeah. So grateful for you sharing that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. You talked a little bit about it, but maybe you can talk a little bit more about what's on the front for you. I mean, happy birthday, whenever it was. Hey, you know, no one, you know. grateful you are here and energetic and still forward.
Thank you. Yes. Well, I'll say something about a couple of the commitments that I'm living in these days and working with. Commitment being this idea of declaring the future that you want, declaring the self you want to be out of, you know, the embodiment lineage. And the one I've been working with for about a year is, I am a commitment to the peace, wonder, and satisfaction of right now, which even saying it now allows me, I can just feel, it's like everything in my solar plexus just kind of relaxes and I can feel even more of my butt on the chair. It's just this peace, wonder, and satisfaction of this moment. So it's what we were talking about with presence, right? And being right on that edge of the way. But then that's slowly morphing. I think what I've been in the past few months has really been exploring how to just be in my day to day with more flow. I want to say something about teaching. So I talked about teaching about time and time management.
You know, what is managing?
We all want to hear that. That's some corporate bullshit. Yeah. But, you know, we also teach things to learn things. And at some point, for me, really focusing on, it's about creating more experiences of flow, more experiences where I am seamlessly engaged with what I'm doing, right? Where what I am doing, as came up in a tarot reading recently, where I am working, and I think it's the Eight of Discs, which is a card about work and producing and, you know, maybe even practicing the production. But in this particular deck, it was bees making honey, and the sense of where you are so in the work that it, you know, it is the work you are meant to be doing, mm-hmm. and therefore it is like play. Mm-hmm. That's what flow is like, right? So I'm like, oh, I'm actually producing more flow in my life day by day, and different tools and different shout outs to comrades, including, you know, my sister brother, Sindolo Diamina, for some of the tools that helped me with that. But anyway, the commitment that has emerged is I am a commitment to sanctuary and flow. Ooh. And sanctuary really meaning in myself. And we were talking about, you know, some of that whole self, you know, those boundaries. But also, how am I a sanctuary for others, with others? How do I, just by being, in a sense, invite mm-hmm. a safety to be? Now, I don't know the answers. These are the questions I'm in. But that's what's moving forward, I think, is those two pieces and showing up and just how I work with folks one-to-one or train, etc. I'm on the verge of retiring, which means absolutely nothing in terms of working less. It just means probably changing where I live more than anything else. But I do know that inside of that, it's also about having more of this sense of sanctuary and flow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those feel like two of the big pieces. And the final piece, I mean, just inside of Bold, you know, my role these days is very much about supporting our trainers and growing our training team. So I'm in lots of questions about how you create a community of practice where people actually get to practice their values, their principles, the content of what they teach in ways that keep everyone growing. And because Bold is so much about supporting others to be in practice in community, whether those are organizations or a set of organizers or people in a particular place, then it feels even more necessary that we as trainers mm-hmm. know how to do that with each other. So that's some of the edge, you know, of what's next and what I'm looking at.
Wow. That's a gorgeous edge to surf on.
Thanks, Sage. Yeah.
Thank you so much for this time and for this conversation. I'm grateful for your honesty. I'm grateful for your clarity. I'm grateful for your continued grounded assessments and vision of the possibilities. I hold you as a complexity guru. That's what I'm calling you now. Oh. You know, and I'm grateful for what you've shared today and what you continue to share and offer us as we all work side by side to transform the world to one that holds our dignity and humanity central. So thank you so much for all the years that you've been doing it and all the years you will continue to do it. We're grateful for your wisdom.
Thank you so much, Sage. It's a delight being in this conversation with you. Yeah.
This podcast is produced by Natalie Parrott. Music for the Emergent Strategy Podcast is provided by Hooray for the Riffraff and their album Life on Earth. To support the ongoing work of ESII, make a donation at www.alliedmedia.org/ESII.